Well, good morning, gentlemen. Thank you.
Morning.
Joe.
What'd you guys think about the Super Bowl last night? Anybody have any bets on
that? Go Giants. Giants done.
Yeah. You got New York and Massachusetts.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have a kind of an informal conversation, and we're going to start by just having folks introduce themselves and give a few highlights of their organizational priorities. Then we're going to kind of have a dialogue, ask some questions, fairly informal. There'll be instructions on the screen if folks think of questions that they want to ask, and staff can get those to me, and we can take, hopefully have some time to take some questions from the audience. These gentlemen will also be around after the general session if you want to link up with them and follow up with some questions. So why don't we start with a few minutes of introduction? We'll start with
sure.
You, John.
Yeah, John Huber with the National Oil Heat Research Alliance. My organization, which I'm the head of, has been in business for 10 years. We do the research and development for the industry. As part of that, we've worked with NBB to qualify the fuels to be used in the heating oil systems. We educate technicians on how to use setup equipment and install it, also how to use biodiesel in that, and then consumer education, trying to get the American public to understand the value we provide them so that they'll be happy using our fuel. One of the things that we've looked at is biodiesel. Bioheat is something that we need to compete with. You know, you described fettered competition. As an industry, we compete with utilities every day, which are state-sponsored monopolies, much like OPEC. But we compete with them, and, you know, for many years we had a price advantage. We don't have that now. But what we saw as competition is becoming more of a homegrown, more of a renewable fuel so that we could do a better job of competing and serving the needs of our customers. So that's why we've done this long-term partnership with your group, Joe. We've enjoyed it and find it very important to the future of our industry that we get in that path and supply our customers what they want.
Great. Thank you, John. Dan.
Thanks, Joe. PMAA is a national federation, 48 state and regional trade associations who mostly handle petroleum advocacy at all the state houses. We have a representative working every state house in America, which is important, certainly as issues arrive there. It's PMAA's job to look out for the interests of independent petroleum marketers in the national arena. We represent about 8,000 independent petroleum marketing companies, and they're a very diverse group. We have wholesalers, we have companies that are both wholesale and retail, and we have companies that are strictly retail. So it's we cover the whole plethora of independent petroleum marketing companies. The one thing that all these companies have in common is they all have a stake in liquid fuels. We estimate they own and operate approximately $500 million or $500 billion in liquid fuels infrastructure. So we care a lot about diesel, we care a lot about gasoline, and we care a lot about heating oil, and that's where we focus our attention.
That's great. Well, thank you, Dan. John.
Thanks, Joe. Good morning, everybody. New York Oil Heating Association. By the name, it appears as though it's the New York State Association, but actually it's just a city, just represents the five boroughs. It was founded in 1931, believe it or not, to insulate itself from organized crime. You wouldn't think New York City would have an organized crime, but just figure you might want to write that down as a factoid. I guess my responsibilities there mainly are public relations. I do a fair share of lobbying, which I'll admit right now I dislike, but I have to do that. That's part of the game. Public relations, regulatory council as well. And I guess a couple of years ago I was charged by my association to wage some sort of peace with the city of New York, so to speak, because they were looking to clean up their air emissions. You can imagine a city of 8 million people. There's a lot of air emissions. We're in a non-attainment zone. And my charge was to get government and industry to meet in the middle. For air emission issues, I did that two ways, one with desulfurization of the product, and the second piece is why all you folks are here today, and I thank you for being there, is a bioheat mandate, which is going to take effect in October, and we're going to talk about that a little bit later on.
Great. Thank you, John. Appreciate that. Charlie.
Good morning, everyone, and thanks for having me. Joe, for inviting me. I got to admit, I was relatively surprised when I got the call from Joe to represent AFPM, you know, the association formerly known as NPRA, here at your fine conference. I felt like I was going to be a cattle rancher at a vegetarian conference. But we represent virtually all the refining and petrochemical capacity here in the country, over 98% of the refining capacity and virtually all the petrochemical manufacturers. In a little bit of opposition or different opinion as to Joe's fine remarks, I might add, they were fantastic opening remarks.
Thank you.
Although we disagree with a lot of them, I'm sure you're shocked. When we were talking about changing our name, I thought of, why don't we just change our name to the Obligated Party Association? Because basically that's what we are. We need to work together, but we do have both short-term and long-term problems with the renewable fuel standard. We do believe in the consumer choice and an open market's the best way to go. I'm here to tell you that, again, thanks for the invitation. And I hope we have a full and open, honest discussion because it's critical. We manage critical assets in the country. If these assets aren't continued to produce the fuel here in the United States, you're going to be blending your product with something maybe or maybe not from those same OPEC countries and other unsavory parts of the world. And that's not a good thing. We've got 3 refineries shut down already on the East Coast, 2 before that. And we're hoping and praying and working hard to make sure that's not a portray of the future. And again, thanks for having me, I think.
No, we're glad you're here, Charlie. Thank you. Michael.
Joe, thank you very much for inviting me again to be part of your platform. I, like John Maniscalco, run a trade association of heating oil dealers. We've been around since 1955. These are my friends and colleagues on the dais with me today. I view myself as someone at the epicenter of the change in our fuel, the evolution of oil heating, which you're hearing. Massachusetts integrated the first bioheat mandate in the country in 2008. Although there are some stumbling blocks with the mandate, we are proud of that. And with that, forged a tremendous relationship with NBB, USB, and the Nebraska Soybean as well Association, who have been so generous to us in moving the message and helping our members get epiphanies. I think the title of our session here today is telling. So I'm excited about being here and sharing the dialogue with you and your audience.
Thank you, Michael. Well, speaking of the dialogue, let's get that started. And let's start with you, Dan. You know, I've known you the longest. We've been friends for a really long time. I think we started out as CEOs in our respective organizations about the same time and worked together on a whole range of things over the course of many, many years. And we have members in common. I even have one of your members on our governing board. I didn't get to talk too much in my opening remarks about the tax credit, but I know that's something that your organization has partnered with us on and has been helpful on that. Can you tell us a little bit about what your organization has done in that effort and also some perspective on, you know, the recent lapse? You know, we've lapsed again and comparative to the last time that happened.
Well, we're working with your staff in Washington just about weekly trying to support extension of the biodiesel tax credit. And it's focused strictly on biodiesel. The biodiesel industry is so new and still growing, and it's not as mature as the ethanol industry. So we feel strongly that Congress needs to do the extension, if at all possible. But if you turn back the hands of time to December 2010, you know, Congress made a commitment to you and to us that they were going to extend the tax credit. What happened, if you remember, the health care debate, the senators left Washington not speaking to each other. They were so mad, so the biodiesel tax credit languished. But they said, we're going to get it. We're going to get it done. Well, they came back and continued to fight. But we finally got it done through those joint efforts. And it, like I said, our member companies are liquid fuels marketers. Many of them are active blenders of biodiesel and feel strongly about doing whatever we can to advance the industry. You mentioned in your remarks that the tipping point that took place with the industry in 2011. Well, there was also a political tipping point that took place. And now we have a new Congress. that, for the most part, the cupboard's bare. The appetite in Congress for energy subsidies have almost completely evaporated. We have many supporters, but as much as we will fight for it this year, I really don't predict anything happening until after the election. I think we're sort of stuck in that situation. But we keep asking and keep supporting. You never know where something might break.
You know, last time we had a lot of speculators, folks betting on the comeback of the tax credit. Do you see that happening now, or do you think folks learned their lesson?
I think they learned their lesson. And the commitment from Congress was real, that they were going to provide the credit. But as you know, it took about 6 months to get there, and a lot of nervous members were nervous about the, because they went ahead and offered the credit to their customers in many cases. Totally different scenario now. I think everyone understands that this Congress is a different Congress, and energy subsidies are politically controversial, and there's just not a consensus in this Congress about what to do. Like I said, I think there's a chance after the election, but I think it's going to be tough before the election. So our member companies have adjusted to the notion of doing the blending, advancing the product without the subsidy.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, John. In your opening remarks, you mentioned the commitment of your industry to bioheat, your vision of the future. Can you elaborate on that a little more?
Yeah, absolutely, Joe. I think kind of we as an industry, you know, the primary competitor is natural gas, as I indicated in my remarks. One of the things that's been something that's a pressing public policy issue, both at the state level and the federal level, is greenhouse gases, global warming. Our industry did a research project to look at how we compare to natural gas, kind of an open look, not to kind of chastise them or build ourselves up, but get a real view of how we looked at each other. And when we did that, we looked at all the data, came down to saying that if we were blending in the range of 10 to 12% biodiesel, we would be at an equivalent level with natural gas. And anything higher than that would be better than natural gas from a long-term perspective, which from our industry's perspective put a marker out for us as to where we need to get to, and also showed us the potential and the people who work in state governments and federal governments that we could get ahead of natural gas in the long term by going to a greener fuel. So that's something that we staked out as something that we need to get to. And then the support that we're doing the research with your organization, co-sponsored, I think, by some of the state soybean associations, to help us develop the technical ability to get there. So that's kind of the vision we have of going to a much cleaner, greener fuel in the long-term future. And, you know, I think we're fortunate that, you know, in the early 2000s, you essentially fell into our lap as a solution to being able to take us to a greener future, to move us away from, you know, OPEC oil, as that became a pressing need in the, you know, as we had two wars, you know, earlier in this decade. So it's something that we saw as an essential part of how do we move forward as an industry.
Great. Well, following on to that, you know, John's got the national perspective and really the vision for the future. But Michael, from the state perspective, I mean, you represent a New England state that, you know, the highest concentration of heating oil is in New England, kind of in your backyard. And, you know, your folks are not waiting around for some vision of the future to develop. Your folks are delivering now, to use the theme of this conference. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure, Joe. I mean, as John mentioned, he's the largest heating oil state in the country. We're the third largest in terms of volume, so it's fertile territory for blending the fuel and loosening the shackles from OPEC, cleaning our fuel up, and we compete very heavily with the natural gas utilities. It's a pitched battle, truly is, one that it gets very aggressive. So we saw this as an evolutionary change for our fuel. Our members have embraced it in a wide stance. Most are selling this on a voluntary basis as we work through some of the mechanisms of our mandate. But with your help, we have given our marketers the tools they need to understand how to sell the fuel and how to educate their own employee base as to how to market it as well. So we're very happy with where we're going in terms of strides. We need to take more effort there and work closely more with you and your group. But a tremendous effort already is moving forward.
Great. Thank you. Charlie, first of all, you just changed your name from NPRA to AFPM. Now I heard that maybe change again to the OPA. Is that right?
Don't think so. Just got the new cards printed. We're not going to go through that again.
All right. Well, you know, I really want to commend you for being here because, you know, it wasn't very long ago that our two associations were on the opposite side of some litigation over the RFS. So I'm glad that you're here to have a dialogue about it. I've been talking with many of your members over the past months, and they are really mad about those NOVs, and they're justifiably frustrated with the process. So I suspect that we're not going to agree on everything, especially in terms of the RFS. But you know, I also believe that you can't find common ground unless you sit down and talk about it. So very pleased that you're here. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate being here. Given what's happened to my industry and, you know, over the past 10 or 12 years and looking at the photo you had of your first guitar, I harken back to Dire Straits and say, maybe I should have learned how to play the guitar. But seriously, we have to work forward, especially on this fraudulent RIN debacle. It's just unfortunate. And you mentioned it in your opening remarks there, Joe, about how we feel like we were forced to buy these things. These folks are supposedly registered by the EPA. We go out and do it. They're frauds. We have to buy them again. We get NOVs, and the EPA says to us, caveat emptor. So it's like you going to a stockbroker buying stock. It's fraudulent. Feds come in and say you got to buy it again, and by the way, you got to pay a fine for buying it. So this makes no sense. But going forward, now we will work with you. We've got to get our own act together. So we've got to get our lawyers huddled, which is always fun.
Always expensive.
And expensive. You're very good, John. But on the total RFS and Joe, when you mentioned the RFS, and rightfully so for you and your fine organization. You're looking at this part of it. When refining industry sees the RFS, we see the whole thing. And for us, it is not working as intended. Or maybe it is, and that's really a problem for us. If anyone out there in the real world would have, over time, 22% of your market mandated away, I don't think you're going to stay in business too long. If you have to go out and buy credits, RINs, for a product that doesn't exist, EPA knows it doesn't exist, you know, what the heck are they thinking? When you have to go and you blend a product that's going to lower gas mileage, at the same time, EPA is telling you to reconfigure your product to increase gas mileage. When you have to blend a product, it's going to perhaps increase, not perhaps, when you come out with regulations that you have to put equipment on the refinery that's going to increase CO2, at the same time they're telling you to decrease CO2. You wonder why we're a little bit paranoid. And we haven't even huddled the lawyers yet, and we're paranoid. But, I will disagree somewhat again with Joe and probably most of you good folks out there. I believe the RFS is an anachronism. Perhaps in 2007, when we were looking at where production was in the country, natural gas, we're looking at the craziness going on in the world, which hasn't changed much, if anything has gotten worse. But back then, we all thought that we were a energy poor country. We're not. We're an energy rich country. When the president says we have an all above solution, all the above solution and all in, then he retards the 700,000 barrels a day coming from Canada. Now that's 700,000 barrels. That's 42 times 700,000. Joe just mentioned you good folks passed the 1 billion gallon mark. So that's just one project, but you know, offshore Bakken, Marcellus, Utica, Texas Eagle Ford, Barnett, we're energy rich. Should biodiesel be part of the mix? Absolutely. Absolutely. No question. Should there be a tax credit? Well, that's another story. Should there be a mandate? Well, you know, if it's a good product, which it is, if it can compete, which it does, so be it. But again, we as the industry can't just focus on your particular bucket, as we call it. We have four buckets that EPA so graciously gave us. And I know I got a couple of good friends out in the audience, at least two of them, Paul and Mary, are from EPA, are out there somewhere. So all apologies to you guys, but you guys screwed this one up. Okay.
Joe, I want to clarify something, too, because I'm sort of worked both with Charlie and his members and your members, and a lot of the unhappiness with the RFS is really focused on the ethanol side of the equation. Not a lot, you know, there's not a lot of criticism or critique in Washington, but there are some real problems. As Charlie mentioned, cellulosic ethanol doesn't exist, but they have to blend it or buy credits. We can't blend the X gallons of ethanol required under the credit because we're stuck at E10. We can't go to E15 because of legal. So, in other words, I want to make sure your audience understands that a lot of the focus in Congress and happiness with the RFS is really with the ethanol components, not biodiesel.
Yeah. But, and one last thing. I am taking applications to hand over to EPA for anybody who wants to voluntarily become an obligated party. It is so much fun for you.
A lot of takers.
I want to get John in here. John, you alluded in your opening remarks to the New York City mandate, and yep. that was quite an experience. Do you want to tell us more about that?
Oh, yeah, lots of exciting things going on back home. Like I mentioned, we start the mandate. We call it the bioheat bill because mandate's not a nice term for an executive to use because that's something that's force-fed, so to speak. But it's a bioheat bill. It takes effect in October. It's kind of interesting the way it came about. The initiative started actually in 2007. A very smart councilman came to me and said he wanted to do something for the environment to clean up the air in New York City. And I was kind of like under the gun to try to do something like that myself. So we kind of like got together and talked about the bill's language, which is most important in any lobbying effort, is what's in the bill. The original bill was very intense. It had... It started out with a B5, and then it phased up to a B10, a B15, and then a B20. And in between all that, they had desulfurization regulations that took the sulfur from 2,000 parts down to 500 to 15. It was just a bit too chaotic. What we actually, planned on and got to the end point was a 2% bioheat mandate. And I guess you might ask the question, why 2%? I mean, 5, 10 and 15 sounds pretty good from your perspective, but you have to understand the job that I had to do. I was kind of like on a bridge in between government and my member companies. Government wanted to do something, change the type of product that we've been delivering for decades and decades. In fact, the oil that we deliver today is the same oil that I personally delivered back in 1971, short of the color, so we were due for a change. So we kind of like moved along. And I got my people to agree on the 2% because they have to deal with the infrastructure because it's not about the retailers. It's about the terminal operators. So their infrastructure to go to 2%, whether it's 2% or 22%, it's the same infrastructure. So the 2% was not a scary number to my member companies. They applauded it. They engaged it. And we got the bill done. You should also know that it's very feedstock neutral. But you also need to know that the first feedstock that pops out, which is the most prevalent, is, in fact, soybean. So that's how it goes in a bill like that. So that's kind of like good for everybody. When the mandate starts in October at the 2%, I'm probably going to require about 15 million gallons. And then I'm going to rapidly try to get it to the B5 as quickly as I can because that's kind of like the demarcation line for the burner manufacturers. And that's going to probably cost about... I'll need about 35 million gallons. And then as quickly as I can, I need to get to B12. That's the 12th percentile. That's going to put me in the 80 million gallon range. And I need to get there ASAP because, as John had mentioned, that's what gives me parity with the natural gas industry, and that's our direct competition. So rest assured, my fellow farmers and farmettes, that I'm going to get this as high as I can, as quickly as I can. Just one more comment, if you don't mind, about a recent advertising campaign that took place in New York City. It was broad-based. It was had radio spots, had a lot of outdoor, we call outdoor media. We had the subway car cards. It was on the Long Island Railroad, cars itself, on platforms. It was on buses. And this was all due to the gracious efforts of the Nebraska Soybean Board, the United Soybean Board, and also, obviously, the NBB. That was a $385,000 campaign. So on behalf of myself, all of my association members, I can't thank you enough for doing that, especially at a time when there are no advertising dollars available in New York City. You pushed the needle over on the impressions of BioHeat. We got numerous calls, numerous unique hits on the BioHeat website. So once again, thank you for doing that. Greatly appreciated.
That's great. Thank you, John. I just want to remind the audience there's ways to text your question. If you have questions, text them in. We'll bring them in. We'll try to get them on. I want to go back to the RFS and ask you, Charlie. I mean, clearly not all organizations or industries can agree on everything. I mean, clearly it looks like we're not going to agree on, being really excited about the RFS. We're excited about it. Doesn't mean you have to be sworn enemies on everything, and we are fully committed to stamping out any fraud or invalid RINs in the system, and we really want your members' participation in that. So will you participate? After the lawyers kind of get their things done, will you work with us on that?
Absolutely. But again, we have to run through a series of hoops. Again, just on what day is today? Monday. Just on Thursday or Friday before I left the office, we got the notice of the 48 million invalid RINs by the one company. 48 million.
Wow.
And they got one NOV. Why only one? I hope it's a big one. But no, we really have to ferret out how we're going to make this thing work. As long as it's on the books, we have to make it work. One of the problems we have with RINs and volumes is that if you look at the total demand, it's just flat or in some cases is declining over the years, especially since the price shocks at summer 2008 and recession of 2009, and you tell me whether we're in or out of a recession right now. I don't know. But the RFS is a volumetric, not a percentage. So if you look at what's happened, and Dan alluded to it earlier, again, from the ethanol side, we're like this, and the inexorable march, so that delta is out there a lot faster, so we have to blend more and more, and it may not be out there. We have to buy RINs, and this is part and parcel of the heart of some of the fallacy of the way the RFS had been written back in 07. So we have problems as in the industry of complying. Dan mentioned the E10 blend wall. We are really up against it. Probably end of this year or beginning of next, we're going to pass that magic E10. Now EPA came out and said that upon a petition from Growth Energy that anything over E15 was good in automobiles from 2001 to 2011. They did it in two separate segments. I looked at my owner's manual. New, brand new car. After 17 years, I finally broke down and got a new one. And I mean, you got to read the owner's manual on these things just to turn the radio on these new cars. And I got to the point that was interesting to me is, and it's a fuel one, it said, anything over E10, not recommended. And that's lawyer speak for we're going to void your warranty if you put anything over E10 in here. That's a 2011 vehicle. So as it turns out, Congressman Sensenbrenner asked all the autos, all of them, all the manufacturers, tell us what you think. Every one of them came back, domestic, foreign, whatever they are these days. No, we're not going to do it. The marine manufacturer said, no, we're not going to do it. The outdoor power equipment people said, no, we're not going to do it. But EPA is going to come up with a 4x4 sticker on a gas pump that says, buyer beware. You know, first of all, can you imagine grandma out there in the middle of winter, she's going to change this to put this in here, or somebody trying to do a lawnmower thing versus their car. And I have to ask EPA a question. When was the last time EPA ever did a regulation that the consumer was responsible for its compliance? They always told us that was verbatim. So, again, that's why I keep going back to you, Joe, and your guys here. Now, we have disagreements. Again, we're never going to agree on a mandate. We're never going to agree on subsidies. But, blending, all the above, hey, fine. But we have substantive problems with the whole RFS, and unfortunately, you're part of it. You just can't extricate yourself from that total ESA 07.
Yeah. Well, not to be contentious about it, but just to challenge a little bit about what you just said, and this kind of comes from a card, but, it sounds good to say we're not for mandates, we're not for subsidies, but if not that, then what? I mean, the petroleum, everyone knows that we need to do something to diversify our energy. I mean, it's clear, it's obvious from we need more energy and we need a more diverse portfolio. So if not that, then what? I mean, we need some kind of an energy policy, and free market, free market speech, everybody, mandates has a negative connotation. Subsidies have a negative connotation. But if not that, then what? The petroleum sector has a 100-year head start on us. We're just this tiny little group. And the energy markets, as you know, are the most violently unstable. So, when things are going up, it's great. It's economical. Everybody's looking for alternatives. Then it takes a dive. We're snuffed out. So there has to be some kind of a policy. If not that, then what?
Consumer choice. That's what kept this country going for how long we've been around. The other thing I didn't mention was up until now, to fund these subsidies, the administration's idea was to take tax provisions, not subsidies as they've been categorized, but tax provisions away from the oil and gas industry and deal them out to the renewables and Solyndra. I take that back. I'm not putting you guys in that category.
Thank you.
No, I apologize for that. That's
Joe, if I could for a moment. I think the word mandate, certainly in my view, and I think John would agree pretty much with this, we were able to use that word and change the dynamic there. By embracing a mandate in the heating oil industry in Massachusetts and New York, we're able to stand side by side with policymakers, environmental groups, and consumers and say that we are willing to do this, even though the word mandate does have a specific connotation, especially in our world. I view it as a public relations coup in as much as we are really embracing it in a very sincere way. We wanted a mandate. We want to change our fuel. We're telling our customers that we want to do this willingly.
But may I add, then why don't you just do it? Why do you need a mandate?
Because I think in many cases, small business really requires a push. In this case, a significant push. Our industry is based on very small business operations, right. Second, third generation companies, and they're entrenched in their ways. It takes us a great deal of effort to convince them to move the needle. And I think with the mandate in our toolbox, we were able to say to them, we have a fuel behind this mandate, which is clearly clean, better for your fuel. It reduces our grip or our foreign oil issues around reducing petroleum use in our respective areas. So in that sense, Charlie, I think it's workable for us.
And you got to realize not only that, but it builds this great partnership between governments and also the environmental community. I mean, back in the day when we were getting through this legislation, we had a litany of environmental groups that were on our side in the same room talking things through. Back in the day, if an oil guy walked into a room with all these enviros, they'd break out into a rash. I mean, I was not a well-liked type of guy. But now we have this forged relationship where if I need them to do something, a case in point, we wanted to get a renewal on a tax credit in New York State. Mm-hmm. Which is for the bioheat. It's 1 cent per percent that Mrs. Jones gets. So if they're doing a B5, at the end of the year, they get 5 cents per gallon. They take it on a personal income tax credit. This thing expired on December 31st. The environmental community, And I have to tell you, the point of the sword on this whole initiative in New York State was the NBB, by the way. And they pushed this thing through even in this hard economic time in New York State. It was renewed for 5 years, so we're kind of like golden on the tax credit till 2017. So that's part of what that works. Another comment to keep it positive on NBB, because, you know, I have to shout out to Shelby Neal. Right now the mandate is New York City only. That's about one-third of the state from a gallon perspective. NBB is looking to broaden this to make it statewide. You know, it's kind of like they're talking to my state association as we speak. I think a fallback position, if it's not the entire state, is going to be what we call downstate, which would also incorporate two-thirds of the gallons. So the way it's looking in New York State, there's a lot of positive stuff. New York City now for mandate only, possibly downstate, which takes in two-thirds of the gallons, and then a phase-in of upstate. So once again, thanks to Shelby Neal and the NBB for all that they've done for the state of New York.
Great. Thank you. Yes. Thank you, Shelby. Does a great job. Charlie.
Do you think that the RFS has played any role at all in the shutdown of those refineries on the East Coast?
I think the refinery shutdown has a lot to do with the Brent versus the WTI.
That's a lot.
And
yes.
I think it's got to do with the aging of their equipment. You know, we had some issues with the refineries when we changed the sulfur limitation from 15 down to 2, of 2,000 down to 15. There were certain refineries that were against it. Those same refiners happened to be closing it short of Sunoco. That was a surprise. But on the other hand, there's, you know, Motiva Port Arthur in Texas is taking their refinery runs from 275,000 barrels a day, I understand, to 600 barrels a day. So that's kind of like a positive. You have a relaxing in the market. There's energy conservation, so all of the demand is down. So, I mean, did it play a part? I'm sure it did, but I would venture more towards the age of the equipment and the Brent crude.
That is no question that the Brent crude is a place. But when you take as starters 10% of your market away, and then telling you, and by 2022, you are going to take, you're going to take 23 or 24% of your market away, and you look at the aging equipment and you say, gee, do I put the 100 to 500 million to 600 million, a $1 billion worth of equipment? It's a no-brainer.
It becomes a business.
This is what I'm saying. And the other thing about, you know, the environmentalists know, the environment. John, you're talking about natural gas being your main competitor, so you have to get it up to a certain level to compete. I understand that, but when the environmentalists looked at the same charts that we did, that everybody did, everybody in this room, everybody across the nation who were in the energy field looked at, 2000, 2001, 2, 3, 4, 5, natural gas production in the United States. Oh, boy, we're going south fast. I have an idea of being an environmentalist. Let's push for natural gas. We're not going to produce it. The prices are going to skyrocket, and all this other stuff's going to be competitive. And a funny thing happened along the way. 2006, 7, 8, 9, 10, Marcellus, Texas Eagleford, Barnett. So what's the environmental theory now? Anti-hydraulic fracturing. Because we don't want natural gas either. We don't want hydrocarbons. Guys, you're tied to the hydrocarbon industry. You got to figure out a way to keep the American refiners alive and well. And right now we're not. And the RFS is a big part of that, and other things. So we got to figure. Again, unless you want more East Coast, and there could be a lot more out there. Tier 3 gasoline is one of them. Lowering that sulfur again. Again, I'm here. You know, I'm the only person representing the refining industry in this large crowd. But these are real problems. We don't make these up. I wish we could. But they're real.
And Charlie, I guess the one difference, you know, between kind of your sector of the industry, which, I mean, we all overlap a lot, you know, between us. But, you know, and Dan alluded to in his opening remarks, we're a liquid fuel industry, and that's kind of our bread and butter. We have tank trucks. We have terminals. We deliver to tanks in people's home. That's our system, you know, the heating oil dealer. We joked yesterday, electric cars are probably more of a panacea than they are, or a pipe dream, I guess it'd be a better way of terming it, than that. But, you know, for our industry, we compete with electricity, natural gas, and the liquid fuels. So, you know, our real goal is to keep the liquid fuels as one of the three main competitors, you know, as opposed to electricity and natural gas. And this was just a, you know, one way of trying to do it, you know, hopefully contain, you know, because, as I said, you know, the utilities, the natural gas, whether it's electricity or the other, are typically in close alliance with the state governments, much more connected than we will ever be. So we're just trying to make sure that we try to level it as much as possible so that when those unholy alliances, we have something to fight with.
Well, I just caution the unholy alliances.
I understand.
Well, I've got a question based on not unholy alliances, but some strange alliances that have kind of come together. You know, ironically, a lot of these questions from the audience have been answered from a lot of this discussion. But here's a question that says, are there any more of those NOVs coming? Are we going to expect more of these shoes to drop? And is that an issue that threatens the broader RFS program? And before I throw that to whoever wants to take it at the panel level, and I suspect, and I'd like to hear from Charlie on this, but the rest of you as well, you know, one observation is that NBB particularly, and this wasn't common among other renewables and other groups, but NBB particularly demonstrated a lot of restraint during the 2010 oil spill. We didn't use that to characterize the petroleum industry, disparage the petroleum industry, because again, all of our members have partnerships with, have customers and contracts and partnerships with the petroleum industry, and it is our policy, which I think is a fairly wise policy, not to badmouth your customers. So we've worked very hard at that and always done that. So we hope that that was noticed. We hope that we get some points for that. And I will also say that it's been my observation that, you know, during these NOVs and these RIN fraud notices, that I would say that the petroleum industry has demonstrated some restraint in not bad-mouthing the biodiesel industry and sort of characterizing the whole biodiesel industry as, you know, a bunch of ne'er-do-wells, because I will tell you, our industry is made up of hard-working professionals that know their industry, they know their job, and, you know, we're very proud of that. And these folks that committed these alleged crimes, right? Nobody's been convicted yet, but right. If the charges are true, these are not members of our industry. These are criminals. So if the charges are true. So we want to acknowledge that the petroleum industry has not, in a large way, sort of jumped on us and used that as an opportunity to disparage it. So thank you for that.
Yeah, it's true.
Joe,
and the other way around,
question,
too, on the spill. But it, you know, there, if anybody in our industry or my association has, please let me know. This is more than an anomaly. It's way off the charts. And as Joe mentioned, nothing can straighten somebody out like prison time. And I'm looking forward to it for several people. But again, just like the oil industry shouldn't have been, you know, hit with a broad brush by a tragic accident in the Gulf, no one in my industry or any other industry should disparage your good industry because of a couple of yo-yos. But are there going to be more? I would certainly hope and pray not. But if I had to put my nickel on one way or the other, I think it would be there could possibly be more. But again, that's...
You mentioned in your speech, it should be your highest priority to get RIN integrity. It's a crack in the dike that could grow more severe. So I think you're smart to make it absolutely essential. Do whatever you can, but something has to be done, and the sooner the better.
Right. Well, you know, we are going to work very, very hard, make it a top priority, as I mentioned in my speech, to the point that... I'm personally going to oversee that, staff that, along with our chairman. So it's at the upper scale of the priorities for our organization, for our industry. But as you know, processes like that don't move quickly, especially when you get lawyers involved, you get other stakeholders involved and industry involved. And so there could be, we don't know, but there could be some, well, here's the positive side first. We think we got the big guys. Thanks to EPA enforcement and Secret Service, we think we got the big guys. We've got the biggest part of the pain over with, maybe in terms of getting those first, you know, the first folks caught and on the way to being punished. That sends a very important message. So that's a positive. On the negative, we don't know if there's going to be some more. Probably will be. And so the question is, when there is that going to sort of, you know, by the coalition that has formed to sort of go after biofuels, particularly ethanol, but you know, biodiesel gets the shrapnel from all of that. You know, it's not just petroleum groups, but also grocery manufacturers, the livestock groups, and shame on the livestock groups to attack fellow agriculture. I'll just say that, but
little agriculture,
fellow agriculture.
Oh, I thought you said little.
No, fellow agriculture.
Okay.
You know, grocery manufacturers, livestock groups, even environmental groups, you know, they very much mobilized to go after biofuels, and so are they going? Do we suspect that if there is another case, or there's another cases, you know, that they're going to use that as a, you know, as a baseball bat to beat, you know, biodiesel up?
I believe, Joe, and I hope I'm right on this, that we have never, when we were arguing the coalition that went after the E15, we never mentioned the term biodiesel. It was all, you know, what are we going to do when that blend wall gets cracked? Are we going to dismiss the provisions of ESA 07 and EPA regs and say, okay, we're not going to blend over E10, or are we going to risk the wrath of the customer and the consumer and the potential safety? So that's the Hobson's choice, and I don't think it's going to be a big choice. I mean, I can't speak for individual refiners, but you can imagine how gun-shy they're going to be to market a product like that, and who in the heck's going to sell it? So you need another subsidy to have the marketers put in blend pumps. So when does it end? You know, and on the cellulosic, I got as much chance of buying a unicorn as I do a gallon of cellulosic ethanol on a commercial market right now.
I bet you could find somebody to sell you a unicorn.
I know a guy.
You know a guy?
Yeah.
Up in New York?
Times Square. I can get
but that hasn't stopped. Now, that's scary.
male, female.
That doesn't matter. I thought you cleaned 42nd Street up. but that doesn't stop EPA from telling us that. We know there's none out there, but you got to pay 8.4 million or 8.6 million. This is when it's cumulative, it's additive. Honest to goodness, if it were just you guys, we could work. But it's you know, it's boom, 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 boom. It's everything put together. For us, it's all. You guys and ladies have the, I put this in quotes, luxury of working and compartmentalizing all of this RFS. We don't have that luxury.
Well, they're telling us it's time to go. This has been an extraordinary panel. I really appreciate you guys being up here. And maybe can we close by saying, you know, I thought it was a great dialogue, very constructive. I think we need to keep it going. And maybe can we agree on or agree to disagree on whether we support the RFS in total, but can we agree that we'll work together for that biomass-based diesel category and make it work?
Most important. Yeah.
All Absolutely. Right, great. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Really appreciate
pleasure.
It.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks, all.
All right.